This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is David Sedaris, whose latest collection of essays is titled The Land and Its People. Earlier essay collections include Happy-Go-Lucky, Calypso, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. This is his 14th book. There are two children's books plus a book of diaries. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker and also writes for Esquire, The Observer, and many other publications. This interview was recorded at Book Passage Bookstore in Corte Madera, California on June 9th, 2026. David Sedaris, this book, The Land and Its People, that's the name of one of the essays. Why did you choose that particular name for the book?
Well, when I was looking for a title for the essay, and I remember I was sitting at my desk and it came to me and I was thinking of those books that they had in my youth, Peru, The Land and Its People, China, The Land and Its People. But I thought, get rid of the country and just call it The Land and Its People. And it would suggest a sociological, that the book is sort of a sociological study. And all you need is to mention a place and to mention people, and it fits into it. I really am so happy with the title of the book. So happy. And happy with the cover. And really, there's a story in there about my friend Dawn, right? And yes, she and I, and it takes place in Colorado. The Land and Its People. There's a story in there about Hugh getting his hip replaced. The Land and Its People. Everything fits under that. I just am delighted.
Let's start with the fact that you're writing more about Hugh and Amy and Gretchen and Paul and your godson. Years ago, when I spoke with Nora Ephron, she said she grew up in a family where everybody knew that everybody else would be fodder for their parents' screenplays. For you and your husband and your sisters and brothers, how does that work? Do you let them vet your stuff?
Well, the New Yorker fact checkers always call everybody, so I give them the essay after I've written it, and I ask, is there something you want me to change or get rid of? My brother and I had an argument, 2016, you know, and afterwards he said he didn't want me writing about him anymore, you know, and I didn't. And then, I don't know, it took a long time to kind of heal that argument that we'd had. And we had a reading in North Carolina last month, and everything that I read, he was in, you know, and they were all stories that went into the book. Anyway, he was happy with them all. I mean, I think when we had the argument, his fear was that I was going to write about that. I mean, I have a pretty good idea of what people don't want the world knowing, you know. And usually what I am writing about is funny, and they know it's funny.
Right.
You know, it's not. So they own the laugh. Like that night, it was so nice having my brother in the audience because all those laughs were him. You know, they were going to him. They were for his lines. So he's sitting in the audience hearing himself quoted and having the audience laugh. But again, not laugh at him, laugh because what he said was so funny. But my brother doesn't have... He's not a writer. He's not a comedian. He's the funniest person in my family, but he never learned to direct his humor. He never learned to edit. He never learned to put it into a bullet casing. So it just scatters out. And
what about Gretchen? Has she always been okay with it?
Gretchen? Yeah. I mean, the hard thing about being in my family, I think, is, you know, strangers will come up and say, why aren't you on TV like your sister? Why haven't you written books like your brother? So they're constantly getting that from people. And sometimes it's people think they're funny by saying it and they have no idea how common they are. And sometimes people do it to hurt them. I mean, I've had people come up to me. You know, I was at a reading doing a Q&A and a couple of weeks ago when somebody said, what's it like to live in Amy's shadow? That was one of the questions, you know. And the person thought he was funny because I could see him and he thought he was funny. And, you know, people who think they're funny say all kinds of shitty things. So my brother and sisters get it a lot. You know, why aren't you successful? you know, like Amy and David. And it's hard. It's hard to live with that. And there's nothing I can do about that. And most of them are pretty good about it. And they realize, you know, it's not Amy's fault that some guy in the audience said that.
Right.
It's him thinking he's... It's so interesting to me how people be so invested in pitting you against people in your family. Like, who's funnier, you or the... And it just tells me more about their family, actually. To me, anyway, that's what it's usually about.
What about Hugh? Is he willing to accept everything at this point?
Hugh's word doesn't mean what it used to. Like, if Hugh says you can't write about something, then 5 minutes later, he's like, okay, but just this once. So he's gotten a lot better. But again, there are things about Hugh that people don't know, and there are things that I wouldn't write about Hugh, partly because he's a character. There's Hugh, and then there's the character named Hugh, right?
Right.
And so I have to honor the character of Hugh. The character of Hugh is allowed to change a little bit. He's allowed to grow. Well, at first I liked that TV show Glee, right? And then it seemed like every episode was written by someone they just hired who'd never seen any episodes of the show. There was no continuity to the characters.
Right.
And so there has to be some continuity to the characters.
To that degree, I would guess Amy and Hugh both, there's the character and then there's the person. For you, do you kind of feel that split? I mean, I know I've talked to a lot of famous people. And sometimes you see the real person, and sometimes you see the persona that they're promoting. What is it for you? I mean, how do you deal with it? Or is there another persona?
Gosh, I mean, I don't think. I mean, I think that I feel like the one that's on paper is pretty close to me. Gosh, there are always things when, like, I've never written about sex. You know, I've never written about my sex life. I've never written about, you can't really write about good things that you do, you know? I mean, that's really when people say it's taboo to write about money. Not really. But it is taboo to talk about charitable things you do, or some of you just sound like an asshole, you know? So, you know, I don't talk about those things, and I don't talk about, I mean, I'm pretty upfront about how petty I am, but at the same time, I feel like I'm happy for the success of other people. I'm not, but I think maybe because I can afford to be.
First time my boyfriend's heard me on the radio, he said, "You sound different. You sound like a different person." And it never occurred to me that there was a difference between me, Richie, and Richard on the radio. And I was just wondering, you know, if you're getting up in front of an audience, are you putting on a mask? Or are you removing a mask?
I'm flipping the switch. I'm turned on. I turned myself on. But you have to turn yourself on if you're in front of an audience, because you have to entertain them. And I can turn it off just as easily as I can turn it on.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're on a book tour, it pretty much stays on the entire time. I mean, it's interesting when it's your own self, it's harder to see. Like, I can see it with my sister Amy. I can see how, when Amy's on TV, what you don't see is her curiosity, right? She seems kind of manic, and she seems like of a, you know, talking a mile a minute. Whereas in real life, she's more inclined to ask you questions and to listen to you. But it's sort of her persona is to be kind of bubbly and zany.
Someone asked me, because I've interviewed a number of comedians, and my answer generally is they're not funny, and anything they say that's funny, they're going to keep to themselves because they need it as product, you know, as whatever they're doing. How do you feel about that?
I would never tweet, you know, or I would never have I remember when that Substack first came along, right? They offered me money to do it, but I said no because I knew that everything I put on there would just be stuff I couldn't get published anywhere else. So it wouldn't be my best stuff. And so why would you put it out there? Because then people would, like, it's not helping you any, because people would read something that was not its best and then be offered a ticket to come and see you. And they'd be like, no, he's not that good. I don't want to see him. But I can understand too, like, I think it's Jerry Seinfeld who had written somewhere that he wouldn't get on Twitter, because why would he give those jokes away for free if you can get up on stage and do them? People have asked me before, like, why don't you have a podcast? And to me, to have a good podcast, that's a full-time job. You wouldn't have time to do anything else. If you were going to have a guest on who's a writer, you'd need to read the person's book. You know, you'd have to watch the person's movie, or you'd have to. And that's a full-time job. I mean,
that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
People don't know.
But I think sometimes people think, oh, we'll just get on and we'll have a conversation. And it'll be like, just like we're sitting in the living room talking. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be interesting.
I want to get to a couple of the other elements in your book, David Sedaris. It seemed to me that even though you're not talking about your sex life at all, you're blunter about making sexual jokes than I've seen in the past. And you're also more willing to talk about getting old, which as another boomer is fine with me because I get all of it. Is that just organic, or are you suddenly saying, I'm older, I feel freer?
It's just organic, you know. I mean, it's just, I mean, I'm 69. So, and I just recently reached that age when people call you sir. And then you think, oh, they're just being polite. They call everyone sir. And then you're like, no, I'm old. Like, you know, you catch sight of yourself in a shop window and you're like, fuck, how did that happen? I'm old. So it just kind of happened. And I just sort of, I don't know, it colors my life at this point. You know, when you start having medical problems and you start, I mean, I couldn't have written about it earlier, because I didn't know it was coming.
Switching subjects, you also talk a little bit about AI and ChatGPT. Had that been in the back of your mind to always work on an essay on that as you heard about it? In other words, that topic, how does it come? Do you just kind of like look through your diaries and say, this is something I want to use? Are you looking at a newspaper?
Well, the chat, so I mentioned it. I didn't think that AI had any place in my life. And then I realized, oh, well, yeah, I do Duolingo. So that's all AI, which I was kind of horrified to learn. But so it does have take place in my life, and it does play a role in my life. And then also somebody had sent me something that they had asked ChatGPT to write something in my style. And so it wrote what it said was in my style, what it thought was my style. And then I rewrote it. And it's my biggest laugh in the entire book, because it shows what AI can't do. But that was just a flat out diary entry. And then whenever I go to the beach with my family, I feel like the country's in a different place and my family's in a different place. And I feel like I always get an essay out of it. And so that was our last family beach trip. And then we're going this August too. My family's going to get together. And who knows? I really hope that it leads to an essay. But again, it's the country feels different and the family feels different and the family's getting older. And where we're going, where we have our beach house, a very, very conservative area. And that affects things as well.
Do you doom scroll? Just look online and see all the awful things that are going and try to get away from it, but find yourself addicted?
Sometimes, I'll look on Instagram and then fall into that hole. But I feel like it's peeking up America's asshole. That's what it feels like to me. And you're just kind of seeing it all there. And so, not on TikTok, but it's just Instagram, but it's not following people I know. It's just letting it show me things. And it's a lot of people having fistfights in stores.
Something that's happened with me the past month is writers are getting a letter purportedly from me saying that I want them on my program.
Really?
And this is a scam. I've gotten about 20 letters and I've forwarded them to Pacifica Foundation. Have you been the subject of any of these kinds of scams like that?
No. No. That's so interesting. No, I haven't. I mean, I just delete a lot of things because anything that involves clicking on something, I just
I do too.
Delete it. So Maybe I'm just getting rid of them before they get to me, but no.
It's pretty frightening, you know, to see a letter clearly written by AI detailing their book, which is usually either self-published or small press. And then they go to my site or Facebook and see that I've written that there's this scam. And then they write to me. Then I forward it to Pacifica, where the lawyers have tried to get a cease and desist. But of course, they can't get hold of the scammers.
I've never heard of that.
Well, now you have. You also talk more about your mom and dad. And it feels as if the memories of your mom are getting better and the memories of your dad are getting worse.
Well, I always loved my mother, you know, and to this day, we sit around and talk about her and talk about how much we miss her. We never talk about missing our father. Like, I've never heard anyone say, oh, I wish I could get dad on the phone, or, oh, it's Father's Day and I can't call him or visit him. Like, he overstayed his welcome. You know, basically. So, but maybe, I don't know, in 10, 20 years, I'll look at him differently. But, you know, he wasn't a very nice person. You know, I was just thinking the other day, you know, the first book of mine to get on the New York Times bestseller list was Naked. I was in a bookstore in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and my publicist called and said, your book is number 8 or number 12 on the New York Times bestseller list. And, you know, that's every writer's dream. Like, I didn't even allow myself to dream that that could happen, you know. And so I asked if I could make a long-distance call from the store. And I called my father. And I said, my book has made the New York Times bestseller list. He said, have a nice life. And he hung up the phone on me. That was his response to me getting on the bestseller list. And it's just the thought that it angered and hurt him so much. Because all of his life, it was like, you're nothing, you're a failure, you're not going to make it. Why you bother trying? No one cares what you have to write. Nobody, you know, like, you need to study computer science and you're, you know, you're a loser. And this was the world saying, like, no, you're not. And he just couldn't handle it.
Well, by that time, you were already on This American Life. I mean, you were known, weren't you?
A little bit, yeah.
What about Amy? Did he see her success in a different way?
He didn't like that she played unattractive characters. That bothered him, that she wasn't pretty on television, because he wanted people to on television see a pretty daughter instead of seeing someone with a humpback, you know, and somebody. You know, a face with buck teeth but that, you know, that's Amy. I mean, she is really happy when she can wear a lot of, you know, can hide behind a character.
One thing I noticed about most of your observations is that they're similar to observations that I see, but I don't write about, and that others see. And I kept thinking that's where David Sedaris is, seeing things that we all see, but you're writing about it, and then we have the recognition.
I think so. I mean, I don't think I'm terribly different from anyone else, right? I mean, I know for myself that sometimes my brother Paul recently, I went to visit him at his house, and he's a slob, and his house was clean. And he said he'd spent 5 days cleaning the house. He said, and you got to be mad. You know, you got to be mad to clean. And Amy and I were like, oh, my God, we thought we were the only ones. You know, like the second I plug in a vacuum cleaner, I'm furious, you know. I'll take something that happened 30, 40 years ago to reflect on, to be angry about. But anger is feeds the steam engine when I'm cleaning. And the second I'm done cleaning, I'm in a great mood. Right. But it was he said that. And it was one of those things that I thought I was the only one. And Amy thought she was the only one. And I love things like that. Right. When you can write about something you think is particular only to you. And then you find out that it's everyone's experience, but they've never put it into words, or they never noticed it. And I think they didn't notice it because they're not writers. Like when, I mean, if you write, you're constantly, me, constantly searching. I never turn that switch off either. I'm constantly looking for things. I'm constantly noticing details, or just the same way a comedian is, any kind of a writer is, you know, you're just constantly on the hunt for material.
Well, just like we were talking before I turned on the recorder and I said something and you started to laugh, and suddenly you pull out your notebook and jot it down. And now I know you're going to go to that website and you're going to take a look. And did you write down the second website?
Yes, I did.
Yes, you did. And you wrote down both websites, and that might be nothing, but it could be something.
Well, the same last night, I was talking to somebody, I was signing books, and he told me about a friend of his mother's who wanted to be a flight attendant but had bad acne scars. And her name was Frosty. And I wrote from that down too, because it's just so good. You know, the name is so good, and just the fact that she wanted to be a flight attendant. And I don't know, I'm in a nice position that I get to talk to people who I don't know, and I get to ask them whatever I want. Right. So I can't ask the desk clerk at my hotel these questions. And now I found a salesman today that I could ask those questions of. I walked into a fancy shop and there was a guy in there, and I thought, I'm going to leave. I don't really need anything in this store. And he was so delightful and so open and such a fun character and such a fun person to be with that I wound up buying something I don't need at all. I'm not even sure how much I like it, but I liked him, and I felt so very lucky to have met him. But he was open. Like when I went into the store, he didn't say, "Welcome in. How's your day going so far?" That shuts everything down, you know? And he started off by telling me something personal about himself. Or maybe he just said, "No, my boyfriend and I," you know, just even offering that. I mean, I figured he was gay, but it was an intimate experience, you know? And it was a lovely connection with another person, and I treasure it. I'll never see him again, probably. I don't know that either of us ever needs to see each other again, but it was what I longed for, you know, a connection.
It makes me think of the essay in which you do talk about people going, "How are you?" as an opening, or perfect, or fine.
If I had a store and you walked in to my store, I would have a crossword puzzle, and I would say, "What's a seven-letter word for anticipating?" You came into my place of work, and I asked you for your help. And that's how I would begin a relationship with a customer. Not by saying, "Welcome in. How's your morning going so far? Got any big plans for the weekend?" Like, that, the script doesn't advance anything, right? Yesterday, I'm on this book tour, so I get into a car, and the driver's waiting for me, and he says, "How was your flight?" And I said, "You know you could do better than that." I said, "You know, everybody, you say, 'How was your flight?' And they say, 'Fine.'" I said, "It doesn't advance anything. It opens no doors." And he looked like I'd slapped him. And then we get into the car, and we had the best conversation in the car. And I found out he used to be a tour guide, and that he was so embarrassed by, you know, he had laughs that he, you know, jokes that he put on his little tour that people would laugh at. And he would repeat the joke day after day and then feel so ashamed of himself for repeating the jokes. Anyway, we were just together for half an hour. But again, I felt so fortunate to have spent time with him and to have made a connection with somebody. But you had to push beyond, "How was your flight?" You had to say, "No, we're not opening that door. We're going to open this door over here instead," you know? And some people, when you open the other door, they're like, "I'm not doing that. You know, I'm not." And then fine, we can just be in silence if that's what you want. But I don't know, the right questions can really unlock a person. And it's my job to do that. And it's my job to, and I don't mean so I can exploit them. I just mean so I can hear what it's like. You know, the fellow who took me to the airport this morning wants to be a pilot. And he has a girlfriend who's from Thailand. And when he goes to he's like 6'7", this guy, and like super handsome. And women just throw themselves at him when he goes to Asia, just throw themselves at him. And it was, no one's ever thrown themselves at me. So I really liked hearing about that aspect of his life. And it was, again, I felt very, very lucky to have spent time with him.
David Sedaris, a lot of these essays over the years, you go from topic A to topic B to topic C, and sometimes you come back to topic A again. When you're creating the essay, when you're saying, okay, now what? How does that process work? You suddenly go into your diary. Does a thought come up in the middle of the night? Oh, I could connect point A to point B.
Sometimes a thought comes in the middle of the night and I realize that I can connect point A to point B. I don't like to think ahead. You know, I like to be at my desk and have things come to me because I feel when I'm trying to force things that I'm trying to force it. It was like when I was would only write fiction and I would think ahead and I would say, oh, the person's going to go to their stepmother's party. Then I got to get the person, I got to get the person dressed and I got to get him in the car and I got to, and I'd rather it happen organically. And I guess I know what you mean. I always wanted my essays to be kind of like a Simpsons episode, you know? At the beginning of a Simpsons episode, you have no idea where it's going. And you're not bored, but you just, you don't know where you're going to wind up. And I like that. And often I'm really surprised by where an essay winds up. Like maybe I'll have a diary entry, right? That is just simply a diary entry, nothing more. And then, I don't know, I'll add a sentence to it. And then it triggers something and I think, oh, right, that could, I could connect it to this or that's similar. That kind of feeds into this over here. And so a lot of times I feel like you can't surprise a reader unless you surprise yourself.
Do you ever go, wait, that, I need to find it and spend the next half hour looking through your diary to find that particular?
All the time.
All the time.
All the time, yeah. I mean, I have a diary guide, so when something happens that is particularly entertaining or interesting, I put it on my guide, but not everything goes onto the guide. So there are things that happen that I don't remember what year it was now, and I don't remember, you know, so thank goodness for a search engine, you know, so I can go to 2006 looking for this person's name and 2007 looking for this person's name until I eventually find it.
What about dead ends when you're working on a piece and you finally go, this is not going anywhere, but I like what I have? Do you just suddenly stop it and say to the New Yorker, I have 500 words?
No, usually I think I'm going to go back to this fork in the road and I'm going to take a different direction. So I'm going to lose a page and a half, throw them away so I can't even go back. Because one thing you don't want is like, oh, that's a funny line. I'm going to keep that funny line. Then you're building all this on a on a scaffold of a funny line that's not even going to be funny anymore. So sometimes I just go back a few pages and then take it off in a different direction.
Now, what about at that point? So you've got an essay written, but it hasn't gone anywhere. Is that where, say, an audience would come in for you to refine it? Or is that a completely different process than from just sending something off to the New Yorker?
If I have something and I hit a dead end, then it goes into like a graveyard file.
Yeah. You know?
And sometimes I can pull it out a year or two later and say, ah, that's where it goes. Or maybe something will have happened in the year since I turned, you know, since I have those first seven pages, maybe something happened. And I think, ah, the ending happened. The ending to this essay happened last month, but I had, you know, it hadn't occurred at the time that I wrote it. So it's called attempts. So I have a file called attempts, and it's got a lot of things in it. But I wouldn't do it and read it in front of an audience. Like, I wouldn't read a fragment to an audience, and I wouldn't read something that I know doesn't work. I wouldn't do that to an audience.
Well, what about you have something, and you think it works, and you've laughed, and you put it in front of an audience? What do you get out of the audience what kind of revisions do you get from having watched, listened, sensed the audience?
Well, sometimes I realize, like this, an article I wrote about for a magazine about Comme des Garçons, right, clothing. And I laughed a lot when I wrote it. And I thought, oh, I can't wait to read this out loud. Did not work at all. My audience has no idea who Comme des Garçons is. Didn't work, right? It worked for the magazine because it was a fashion magazine, right? I went to Fiji. I wrote an essay about going to Fiji. Didn't work. And I realized, oh, I went to a resort on Fiji and all I did was bitch about it. And the audience is thinking, I didn't get to go to a resort on Fiji. Do you know what I mean? Here you've got this great experience I didn't have and all you're doing is complaining about it. So I thought, good to know, didn't work. And I didn't. And so I thought, is there another aspect of that essay? And there is another aspect of that essay, but I can't write about it because it would hurt people's feelings. So I can't. It could be a much richer essay. I'm waiting for so many people to die. I can't tell you. Well, there was another essay. It was really one of the best things for this book. And I thought somebody had died, and they hadn't died. I was like, I thought someone had died.
But they hadn't.
And they hadn't died. And thank God I found out that they hadn't died.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, I thought he had died. I thought I heard he was dead. And he wasn't.
What's his name? Dan did die.
Yeah. Well, my friend Dan died when I was. But I wouldn't have written that essay unless Dan had died. Do you know what I mean? So that was an essay written because somebody had died. And the other essay was completely, I don't know, it was a real triumph, I thought. But I felt like it might embarrass this person, even though I'd changed his name. There were only like 5 people who would know who he was, but it might have, it was too embarrassing, I think, for him if he. But the good thing is that hopefully he'll be dead by the time the next book comes out.
That's cold. Contemporary news changes at a moment-to-moment basis. And there is mention in the background, kind of a subtext of what's happening in America with Trump, but nothing up front specifically. Do you write, and would not put it in a book, any essays about what's been happening, say, this month or last month or Iran or fascism?
Yeah, and The Observer publishes that stuff in England. They've been really nice to me. And so the political stuff that I write, it's satire. And they've been great about publishing it. But it's interesting, too. I'm curious to read some of it in England, because when you read it in America, it just feels, I mean, everyone in the audience is on the same page. You know what I mean? Like you're just preaching to the converted. So anyway, I want to try some of it in England and see what it's like there. But it's nice to have a home for that kind of writing. You know, I'm very grateful for that.
When you're out of the country now and in the past year, is the reaction to you any different because of what's been happening with Trump?
I left Europe, gosh, probably in February. So that was before the war started. And so in all over the world, people's energy prices have gone up. Do you know what I mean? So it's going to be an interesting thing to go back and see what that's like. You know, but what I think is interesting is that all these Americans who want to go to Europe now, and they're counting on the Italians and the French saying, well, there's a difference between American people and the American government, aren't willing to do that for Jewish people. You know, they're not willing to say, well, there's a difference between this Jewish friend of mine and the Israeli government. Yet they want the people of the world to do that for them. I think that's interesting.
That's something that I've been noticing is popping up now among my Facebook friends, is the realization that Jews in Israel and American Jews are suddenly being blamed for what's going on in Gaza. But we as Americans want to pass because we had nothing to do with Trump. Exactly.
Okay. And you would think that a light bulb would go, you know, like you'd think that that would occur to people. Do you know what I mean? And they would, I don't know, maybe change the behavior, or they would make that gasp of realization, but I don't see it happening.
Well, there may be an undercurrent of anti-Semitism that is kind of so below the surface that's coming up with that,
mm-hmm.
you know. David Sedaris, do you ever say to yourself, this isn't funny enough, or I'm losing the pathos by throwing in a joke?
Oh, all the time. That's what's good about reading things out loud. I mean, I want it to be funny, right? And so it's pretty easy. I want something to be funny, and if people don't laugh, then I didn't do my job, and it's not working. But you can't say, oh, they don't get it. They're not stupid. You know, I mean, they might not get references, you know, like maybe they don't know who Comme des Garçons is. So you think, okay, that's not going to work for the general public. It's more like for a specialty magazine. But I mean, what I like to do is I like to make notes, and then I like to lay the whole piece on the floor and then look at the movement of it, right? So look at where you get the laughs and look at them swelling and look at them going away and look at them coming back. And then, you know, you throw something in at the end to test people and make sure they were still listening, you know, and if that gets a laugh, that means you didn't lose them with all of this. So it's sort of orchestrating the essays in a way.
The sense I get is that what sounds for people like it was easy to throw it together, it never is. This is hard work.
Yeah, but you want it to look easy.
Right.
You know, you don't want people to see you straining. Yeah, when people say that it looks easy, I feel it's a compliment to me. But yeah, it's a lot of work to get it to look easy.
How many of those little pieces do you have sitting in the temps file now?
Oh, gee, I don't know, 40 at least. And there were a couple of things, something in the book. Oh, there was something called Yes Vote that was from the attempt file. Because I'd tried writing about jury duty before. And so that was taken out. And I thought, and then I thought, oh, this can work now. I mean, there were all kinds of things in there that they're clean, right?
Right.
The first five pages are clean. There aren't repeated words. It flows. It's funny. And then it's a ball.
And you have to make sure that an essay you're writing in 2026 is not a kind of weirdly rewritten essay from 2018, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but that's, then you have to just restructure it on top of everything else, you know, which isn't unheard of, but it's just another thing you have to do.
David Sedaris, you're going to be back, I guess, doing another series of events in the Bay Area next November, I think. Is that for another book or?
No, it's just a lecture tour. So I just finished a lecture tour. I turned my book in February, and then I wrote five new essays, and I took them on this last lecture tour I went in, and I read them out loud and went back to my hotel and rewrote them and read and rewrote them. And so hopefully by the time I start in the fall, I'll have four or five new essays, and I'll be doing the same. You know, be doing the same thing and have them in good enough shape, you know, so that they'll
work. A couple of quick questions. When you're going off to all of these foreign countries, are they deductible? I mean, are you doing it in a way for work? Is it fun?
Yeah. But like I went to Saudi Arabia last summer just for a vacation, and I tried writing about it, and I want to write about it. I can't claim to know anything about Saudi Arabia. I mean, I was there for 2 days, so I can't speak with any kind of authority. And I wrote about it, and it didn't really work. But so it's in the attempts file. But I insist that I can make it work. I'm not done. I'm not done with you, Saudi Arabia.
You've been listening to an interview with David Sedaris, whose latest book of essays is titled The Land and Its People. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays or Mondays. For feedback and requests, you can write to Richard at kpfa.org or bookwaves@hotmail.com. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com
for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.